This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are experts on military issues and intelligence. We've asked them to share their information and analysis relating to the war on terrorism and the Bush administration's plans to oust Saddam Hussein. Joining us from the BBC studio in London is Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. Joining us by phone from Shropshire, England, is Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. Both publications are part of Jane's Information Group, which also publishes Jane's Defense Weekly, a highly regarded source of military and intelligence news from around the world. I asked Alex Standish of Jane's Intelligence Digest if he thought a regime change in Iraq would help in the war against terrorism and the defeat of al-Qaeda.
Well, certainly my view is that since there is, to the best of my knowledge, no proven link between al-Qaeda and the Ba'ath Party regime in Iraq, I don't really see how regime change in Iraq would do very much to assist the war on terror after the 11th of September. Now, that doesn't mean that the Iraqi regime is not a danger to certainly regional security, but I'm certainly not convinced in my own mind that this will greatly assist the fight against militant Islam in general.
Charles Heyman, are you also convinced that there is not a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda?
Well, I've yet to see any evidence of a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda. And most of my contacts in the Middle East say that al-Qaeda is a much threat to the Iraqi regime, because the Iraqi regime, of course, is secular and not seen as being good Muslims by the fundamentalists, as it is to all the rest of us. So I've really, really got to be convinced that there is a linkage, a real linkage between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime. At the same time, we don't really know what regime change actually means. We need it spelt out. Do we mean a government which is imposed by the coalition and then is supported, obviously, in power by coalition troops? Or do we mean the Iraqis are going to choose someone? And that someone, we just don't know what his track record has been and how he'll react in the future. He may be as bad as Saddam Hussein. We just do not know. So we need to know more about regime change as well.
Do you think that you're both proceeding on the premise that there's no link between Iraq and al-Qaeda, but that does that necessarily mean that there wouldn't be a link between them in the near future, since they both perceive the United States and other Western countries as their enemy?
Well, I mean, my personal feeling there, and it is a personal feeling, is that al-Qaeda is so far away in its aims from the secular sort of government that we expect to see in Iraq, that that it's very difficult to put together any sort of answer that suggests that, that there is going to be a linkage that's dangerous to us. I mean, it is quite possible, but it doesn't look likely. It's not something that that we've really been thinking about in great detail, simply because, from my point of view, they are two sort of totally opposed organizations. The Ba'ath Party and al-Qaeda, I mean, are very, very long way apart.
So you both agree that Iraq is probably not aligned with al-Qaeda, and it's unlikely to be aligned with them in the near future. Do you think Iraq or al-Qaeda presents the greater threat right now, and do you think that focusing on the threat against Iraq weakens or strengthens our ability to go after al-Qaeda? Alex Standish?
I think the danger is that we're going to be distracted by the question of an Iraqi campaign at a time when al-Qaeda, which represents not only a threat to the West, but to moderate Islamic regimes throughout the Middle East, is clearly, in the eyes of many Muslims, it has the upper hand. And I think that one of the dangers that we may see coming as a consequence of any attack on Iraq is that there is an upswing of both Arab nationalism and support for more militant organizations such as al-Qaeda. I think they will perceive it not being a legitimate attack in the sense of defending the United States and its allies from terrorism, but far more in the way of America attempting to impose its will on the Middle East, primarily for its own benefit and, of course, for the benefit of its ally Israel. And I think that that is a potentially explosive combination.
Charles Heyman?
Well, I think that Al-Qaeda is the major threat at the moment. Al-Qaeda are responsible for 9/11. Now, Iraq wasn't responsible for 9/11. Iraq at the moment is basically in its box. And a campaign against Iraq at this time, I think, tends to let Al-Qaeda off the hook a bit. It takes a lot of the focus of coalition military operations away from Al-Qaeda and a lot of that focus going elsewhere. At a time when the focus really needs to be applied to Al-Qaeda, simply because that there are some really, really sound advances being made against Al-Qaeda at the moment, and that momentum has to be kept up. I think that if an enormous amount of effort is put into Iraq in the next 6 months or so, then the momentum against Al-Qaeda will drop, and that could cause us some very serious problems.
What are your best estimates of what chemical and biological weapons Iraq has now, and also how far they are in the development of a nuclear weapon? Charles Heyman, you're the editor of Jane's World Armies. What's your best estimate?
My best estimate, and I concur basically with the International Institute for Strategic Studies, is that right at this moment in time, Iraq does not have the capability of projecting a nuclear weapon. It doesn't have nuclear weapons, and it doesn't have the ability to project a nuclear weapon, obviously, I mean, against one of its neighbors. Certainly, there are probably residual stocks of biological weapons and chemical weapons left over from the previous Gulf War, and some of those stocks may have been enhanced very slightly during the last 10 years. But it's very, very difficult to use these weapons effectively in military operations. You have to have large amounts of artillery, usually, to deliver them, and you have to have huge stocks, especially of chemical weapons, to put up a really effective barrage. And I don't think at this moment in time Saddam Hussein has really got that ability. Both at the chemical weapon stocks, for instance, and at the large amounts of artillery that he needs to do that. When it comes to biological weapons, they are very, very, very tricky to use, and they can rebound on you very, very easily. And you never know what the real effects of biological weapons will be. Remember that one of the main effects of a weapon system is to stop the enemy in his tracks and cause maximum casualties as quickly as possible. You can't really do that with biological weapons. It might take some considerable time for the enemy to realize they're actually under any sort of biological attack. So these are difficult weapons to use in a conventional war scenario. And certainly Saddam Hussein doesn't appear to have the ability to strike out at his neighbors. I mean, I was in the Middle East a couple of days ago, and the impression I get from everyone that no one feels themselves threatened, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Syrians, or the Turks, by Saddam Hussein. He is an obvious threat to Israel, but he doesn't seem at this moment in time to be an obvious threat to his immediate neighbors.
Now, are you suggesting that if countries go in and attack Iraq, that Iraq will not use chemical or biological weapons against them because it's not really equipped to use them effectively?
Well, I mean, basically what I'm saying is that right at this moment there may be some residual stocks of biological weapons and chemical weapons in Iraq, but they don't appear to have the delivery means to project them out hundreds of kilometers into their neighbor's territory. They may be able to use them inside their own territory against troops who've actually moved inside Iraq and in small numbers, but certainly not out into the region. There are probably somewhere between about 12 and 20 Al-Hussein missiles with a range of about 650 kilometers, able to reach Israel from western Iraq. That really, really is probably the only delivery means they have. And it's very difficult to deliver biological weapons effectively on one of these missiles, and certainly terribly difficult to deliver chemical weapon because you need so much chemical down to create a sensible chemical barrage, and the warheads are just too small. Biological weapons, for instance, might well be destroyed on impact when the missile actually impacts. So, you know, this is a difficult one for the Iraqis. I mean, they've got to square a very difficult equation here.
Mm-hmm. And Alex Dandish, is there any intelligence that you're aware of that contradicts what Charles Heyman is saying?
No, not at all. I mean, it seems very clear that, as we all know, Saddam has a track record. He did use chemical weapons against, indeed, his own Kurdish population in 1988. But there really hasn't been credible evidence that there has been a massive rebuilding of any of those facilities which were dismantled under UN inspection during the 1990s. And certainly as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, the recent report that was interpreted, let's say, as suggesting by the Bush administration that he was only 6 months away from developing a nuclear weapon, in fact, I think was rather misrepresented. In fact, what the report said was at the time of the Gulf War in 1991, he had been between 6 months and 2 years away from developing a nuclear weapon. And indeed, the recent statement by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN body, indicated quite clearly that they do not believe that Saddam has any residual nuclear capability.
My guests are Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, and Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, and Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. Charles Heyman, since you have to leave in a couple of minutes, I have a couple of questions very specifically about Iraq's army that I'd like to ask you about. First of all, if we do invade Iraq, what kind of army will we face? How much of the army has been rebuilt since the Gulf War?
Well, basically, the army itself has been degraded since the Gulf War. One of their great problems has been getting spare parts and replacement ammunition, things like this, for all of the armored vehicles, helicopters, all of the things that you need to run a modern army. So before the 1990-91 Gulf War, the Iraqi army was relatively powerful in the Middle Eastern context. Now, today, it has got very, very seriously degraded capability, with many of its main battle tanks, many of its military helicopters, armored personnel carriers, artillery, all awaiting spares and not able to be used in the field. So they have a real problem. They're nowhere near as capable as they used to be.
What about Iraq's Republican Guard? During the Gulf War, there was always referred to as the elite Republican Guard, because this was the most worthy force to be contended with. What's the status of this group now?
Well, the status of the Republican Guard is higher than the normal Iraqi army. The majority of the commanders have been appointed by Saddam Hussein. The Republican Guard take a priority on what spares they are that are available. And also, of course, they're better trained. They get a priority on training areas. They get a priority on everything across the board. So there's five divisions, basically. Two of those are tank divisions and three of them are mechanized divisions. But again, they are nowhere near the readiness state and the offensive capability of a comparable NATO division. I mean, they are well, well down below that. And we didn't see them fighting desperately well during the 1991 Gulf War. Out in the open, there is no doubt whatsoever that This is a 1960s, 1970s force. That's how it's put together, and that's the sort of equipment it's got. It would be taken apart by coalition air power and coalition armor in any battle out in the open areas.
Now, Iraq is threatening urban warfare. What would that mean, and are they capable of doing urban warfare effectively?
Well, yes, they are capable of mounting a very dangerous urban warfare campaign, especially in a city like Baghdad, for instance, where there are 7 million people spread out over a very, very wide area, that there is absolutely no doubt that Saddam Hussein and his commanders will put their military assets that they want to use to try and delay or cause maximum attrition to a coalition force around places like hospitals and old folks' homes and kindergartens, and they'll make sure the television cameras are around as well. If you fight in a city, you have a much higher chance of taking casualties yourself. And, of course, you've got the problem of collateral damage to very large numbers of civilians. I mean, imagine someone fighting their way through downtown Boston. I mean, it would be absolute mayhem for everybody involved. So no modern army, and no army in history, really, has ever wanted to fight through a city. I mean, it's always, always safer and easier to try and starve people out than actually fight your way through the building. So That's a real problem for the coalition, and Saddam Hussein knows that.
How could Iraq engage the United States in urban warfare? The United States, for the past few years, has largely done air attacks. How would the Iraqi army lure our troops into the city?
Well, I mean, they can't actually lure them in. I mean, our troops can stand on the outskirts of the city and then make a calculated decision whether it is worth going into the city or whether it's worth, for instance, surrounding the city and cutting off all the movement in and out of the city, allowing all the civilians out and searching them bit by bit, and then starving out, you know, the people who are left in the city, the soldiers and the members of Saddam Hussein's regime. I mean, that's an option. They would only go into the city if they felt that it was possible to go in and maybe get Saddam Hussein and the members of his regime that they want without massive casualties.
From your knowledge of Iraq's military, do you think there are a lot of very disenchanted, unhappy people in that military who will likely defect if we invade?
I think there are probably very, very large numbers of conscript soldiers inside the Iraqi army who want nothing to do with any war against the coalition, and they certainly don't want to fight for Saddam Hussein. They will disappear at the first opportunity. They won't necessarily defect, but if they have a chance, that they will probably go. And we would say that it's possible that, you know, 25% of the Iraqi army do not want to fight. There is another iffy bunch, is the best way to describe it, who will fight if they have to, but would rather not. There will be a small core of people inside both the Iraqi army and inside the Republican Guard who will fight. Now, the big question, and the $64,000 question here, is how many of those people will actually fight. Now, it will be a good percentage. There's no doubt about that. It's probably less than 50%, but that's probably the best sort of answer that I can give you at the moment.
From your point of view, what would it take to actually get rid of Saddam Hussein? What would it take militarily?
Militarily, if you want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, you would probably have to sit down and plan a classic conventional campaign whereby you actually attack, capture, and then occupy Iraq for some considerable time. You're probably looking, if you want to do it that way, of at least a quarter of a million troops. I mean, five to six U.S. divisions, probably a U.K. division, and some more if you can get them along besides. Large numbers of aircraft, and probably large numbers of ships as well, you know, to get people there and to provide aircraft and all sorts of air cover out into the theater of operations. You might have to, for instance, assault and take the port of Basra and use that as a firm base to get troops and logistic supplies in and to base your aircraft around the airfields that are adjacent to Basra. It would be a huge undertaking.
If you are wrong and Saddam Hussein actually uses chemical or biological weapons against the opposing military, how effective, for instance, are the U.S. devices, gas masks and protective suits, how effective are those against biological or chemical weapons?
Well, they're very effective. They've been tried and tested. But what they do is they slow down the tempo of military operations almost to a halt. You can defend well when you're suited up against NBC threats, but it's very, very difficult to attack and keep any momentum going once you're under any sort of attack like that. I mean, and when I was in the military, I mean, and we practiced this constantly, and we found that we found it very, very difficult to keep tanks going, keep armored personnel carriers going, things like that, and do it at the normal tempo. You could do it for a couple of hours, and that was about it. People got exhausted very, very quickly. So that's a real problem.
Just one other question about this. Do you think that the British Army considers this a fairly easy and winnable battle?
That again, is a very, very difficult one to answer. No soldier who has any experience of military operations ever thinks that there is such a thing as an easy and winnable battle. Sometimes you get lucky and there are easy, winnable battles. But always in the back of your mind, you know that the enemy is just as clever as you. He doesn't stand out in the open unless he's a complete idiot to be killed. And if you're really unlucky, you come across the guys who fight like dervishes. And there is the possibility that, this will happen here. I think it may be unlikely. But, you know, military operations are the sort of activity where you really, really can't work out what the end game is going to be. But we don't know. That's the risk in military operations.
Charles Heyman is the editor of Jane's World Armies. Alex Standish, the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, will be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's pick up where we left off with Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Defense Weekly, which is part of Jane's Information Group, a publisher of information on military and intelligence news and analysis from around the world. The report from the International Institute for Strategic Studies, which you've said you basically agree with, concluded that although Iraq was years away from the development of a nuclear weapon without outside help, with outside help and with the delivery of some plutonium, it could make a nuclear weapon in a matter of months.
Well, certainly it depends what one defines as a nuclear weapon. If one is talking about a dirty bomb, that is a radiological device allied to a form of high explosives which can create localized contamination, then an undergraduate student of physics is probably quite capable of doing that anywhere in the world, given the right mix of knowledge and equipment and materials. On the other hand, if one is talking about designing a nuclear missile which can be delivered at some distance towards an enemy, then that is an entirely different state of affairs. And certainly, I think there is no evidence to suggest that Saddam is anywhere close to having such a device. We know that prior to the Gulf War in 1991, he was probably anything from 6 months to 2 years away. But one has to remember that the bulk of the materials that have been worked on, the enriched uranium and plutonium, which Saddam was then in possession of, had to be surrendered as part of the UN regime which was imposed. And so I think it most unlikely.
Do you think that weapons inspection will be able to arrive at any definitive conclusion about the status of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program?
I think they should, if they are given a similar degree of access that they were given in the past during previous inspections. Then I think they should be able to pretty much confirm that Iraq does not have a nuclear capability. I think it will be much more difficult in the area of chemical weapons, because so many chemical weapons have components or raw materials which have dual usage in other legitimate activities. And one would have to certainly say that chemical weapons are probably the area that Saddam has invested most time and interest in. And the evidence of that, of course, were the gas attacks against his own Kurdish population in 1988.
Alex Standish is my guest. He's the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. Jane's reports that al-Qaeda is probably stronger now than it was before September 11th. What evidence do you have of that?
Well, the evidence is in the form of the levels of support which are expressed for al-Qaeda and also for its objectives, which of course are to drive the United States and its allies out of the Middle East and to destroy the state of Israel. And one can see the evidence in the form that the Arab press, the Arab media, and indeed, speaking to Arab diplomats, that there is a feeling of genuine fear and a feeling of genuine anger against the West, and particularly against the United States. And certainly my concern is that will translate on the ground into support, particularly amongst young people, for solutions which one would identify as being terrorist or as being militant, I think is the word I would use.
Now, you report that, your magazine reports that ending the regime of the Taliban in Afghanistan wasn't really a major blow to al-Qaeda.
Well, I think the removing the Taliban regime from Afghanistan had two very important functions. One was that it removed effective state protection from this organization. And the second was that it closed down the terrorist training camps, which were able to train possibly thousands of people. Now, having closed those down, and al-Qaeda, of course, having basically scattered from Afghanistan, one can say that in the first instance, the objective was fulfilled. However, I think the problem is that the training camps that were closed down had already trained hundreds, possibly thousands of al-Qaeda operatives. And these people were scattered around the globe, often way before the 11th of September. So although, of course, removing the Taliban was important, it certainly hasn't, in my view, had a major impact so far on al-Qaeda's foreign activities.
James has basically said that the United States color alert warning system has been overstated a bit, that the warnings have been a little overstated. What's the reason behind that skepticism?
Well, I think the obvious answer to the question is that many of the so-called credible warnings that were given have led nowhere. Now, one could argue that, of course, that's because of increased vigilance and publicity. Our concern, however, is that the whole purpose of conducting a terrorist campaign is to create terror in the population that you are targeting. And one of al-Qaeda's objectives is to cause the maximum disruption to the US in terms of everyday life, in terms of the economy, to inflict as much damage as it possibly can. And one of the concerns I have is that people, on the one hand, will become, I think, very sceptical. The more these warnings are issued, attacks on bridges, for example, or in the run-up to 11th of September anniversary, that there may be some major attack. I think people will tend to become complacent if there are too many of these warnings issued and nothing happens. On the other hand, I think that it also has the effect of continuing to create almost a feeling of psychosis or of restrained terror amongst the population. And while I think one has to be vigilant, and I think that is entirely justified, I think one can also be alarmist. And I think there is a very fine line between the two. And I think that one has to tread very, very carefully so as not to give people within the US or its allies the impression that there are going to be enormous numbers of further terrorist attacks. The al-Qaeda pattern tends to be to carry out one major attack within a given period of perhaps a year or 2 years and then wait for the opportunity to carry out something quite spectacular, as we saw with the 11th of September. So I think they are waiting and they are watching and they are plotting, but that doesn't mean that there will be an incident every day.
Alex Dandish, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Alex Dandish is the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. He spoke to us from the BBC in London. This is Fresh Air.